Welcome back to Normal Men, Blue Sky's favorite, and some would say only, podcast. We take you to the accidentally recorded pour of a delicious ice-cold Diet Pepsi already in progress.
Are you... you Boston redheaded prick. Are you going to drink it? You're not going to drink
it. Hell yeah, Ed.
It's great.
Oh, he's drinking it.
Out of a coffee mug.
Oh, you miserable, miserable man.
We got a stack of them in order for this sweltering podcast experience.
I genuinely didn't know there were earnest defenders of Pepsi until this afternoon. I thought that was just like a myth.
It's like finding some Japanese soldier on an island somewhere who is still fighting World War II.
I'll thank you not to refer to the Pepsi challenge that way.
It's amazing.
This is Normal Men, a podcast from four men who are clinging desperately to normalcy in an era when that's asking a bit too much. I'm George in Charlotte.
This is Proctor Malone in Washington, D.C.
I'm low-tech speedrun enjoyer in outer Florida.
I'm Ed from Boston.
Hey there, this is Go Like Hell Machine, and welcome to Mailbag. We've set up a voicemail box on the website at normalmenpodcast.com/mailbox. Once a month, I'll wade through your questions and your comments, and I'll pick out a few for discussion. Ask us anything, but to be frank, we'll only really be able to get to a few each month, and we want to try to keep it light, so topical questions and funny questions are strongly encouraged. This week, we've got a few questions about the state of things and also a warning for low-tax speedrun enjoyer, so I'm going to jump right into that. Our first caller is from Chicago, and he says that things seem pretty dire out there. Republicans are doing so much that's so profoundly unpopular. Everything seems likely to get them bounced out of office, so why are they going along with it? I'm going to go with low-tax speedrun enjoyer, one of our resident red state swamp dwellers, and ask him what his take is here.
So what was the warning supposed to be?
We'll get to that.
Okay. Okay, so the question is, they're just pushing ahead with stuff, even though it's going to get them all bounced out of office. I would refer back to Tim Walz's comment that you earn political capital to burn it. I wish Republicans were not burning it that way, but that's just, you know, kind of the way it goes, and it's going to suck as long as they have absolute power.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Here is the other message. This caller wanted us to talk about Derrick Henry more, and for you, low-tax speedrun enjoyer specifically, he wants you to know that Alabama is coming for your precious Florida state, and roll tide.
Yeah, nobody's scared of Alabama now that Saban is gone. Like, Kalen DeBoer is going to be gone next year. What did he go, like 9-3 last year? He's probably going to go 9-3 again this year. And in Alabama, they can actually put you to death for that. So I'm not worried. We're probably going to lose. I think we're like a 10-point dog. But Alabama Bammers, you're not.
When did they give Alabama the
anybody? Be serious, sir. You're going to get rinsed by Georgia anyway.
All right, next up, Keith wants to know if we have any suggestions about how to push back on ICE within our own communities, and also wants to know what our sleeper picks for fantasy football are this year. Now, for the first question, I think that immigration advocates have done a great job developing resources to help people kind of understand what their rights are and how to exercise them. And this is a longer discussion that we might take up as a segment in the future. We're going to punt on this one this week, but we'll add some notes to the show notes. But for Keith's second question, I want to start with Proctor. Who's on your list for fantasy football this year? And do you have any surprises?
Oh, man. I haven't sat down to do my drafts yet this year, so I'm a little behind on research. But I love the Raiders offense. I think that Pete Carroll is a better offensive mind than he's given credit for. He's not going to be the guy directly calling the plays, but he did a good job in Seattle of creating structure within which his talented players can freelance. Love the running back they drafted. I think Ashton Jonte's going, I want to say second round, maybe third at this point in drafts. And I think he's going to return first round value.
Yeah, he did a great job when he was having Russell Wilson throw the ball on the 1 yard line in that Super Bowl.
All right. Okay, so here's the deal. Marshawn Lynch has had ball security issues in short yardage situations for years and years and years, including in that particular, I think that was same season, but certainly against the Niners in a previous season, he lost a goal to go fumble. So it's not like just handing it to Lynch to bang in between the tackles is a safe play, particularly since he got completely blown up on the prior play by the Patriots D-line. That was an interception that was an inspired play. Some would say perhaps a cheating play by the New England Patriots, who seemed to know what play was coming, despite the fact that we had not run that particular slant at any point in an NFL game that season. Perhaps this was an instance where Bill Belichick's practice of taping other teams' practices gave the Patriots some warning of what play was coming so that they were able to get in front of the ball. Just saying.
I think Gillette Stadium should be leveled. You're not going to get a rise out of me. I'm sorry to the 12 Revolution fans, but it's got to go.
I appreciate that Propter has brought us a new and inspired ball gossip.
Also, for the Revolutions fan, you really need to get a soccer-specific stadium, so come on.
Wow, I at least gave them 12. You're down to fan.
All right, next up, from Edmonton, we have a Canadian listener who grew up in rural Alberta, and he asks, it seems weird that so many Americans who've never lived in rural places seem kind of fixated on the mythic American heartland, which often feels like a bizarrely sanitized version of what these areas are really like. Why do American elites seem so fascinated by it? So I want to turn to our American expert, George, our resident Canadian, who drives a pickup, listens to country music, and lives in a purplish state, and ask him what he thinks.
First off, to our Edmonton caller, we really appreciate you calling in, and Corb Lund is a god. So let's get that out of the way. Second.
And go Panthers.
Sure. I mean, look, we all need a lost cause in our life to be enthusiastic about. Second, I think the most important difference between the U.S. and Canadian political systems and how that impacts looking at rural people is proportional representation and the fact that in Canada, population weights are all that really matter. The gerrymandering and Senate shenanigans that give the voters in states that have only one congressional district but two senators the same say in the upper house as all of California, which is the world's sixth largest economy, that alone explains the rural fetish. Because if you can win rural voters, you can win a really large legislative mandate, and it's just that simple. I think there is also a peculiar history around the manifest destiny and white supremacy themes in American history that also plays a role here. But really, when it comes down to it, it's the structure of the political system. It's the fact that we don't have fair districts in places that are population weighted, and we give rural voters bonus points in the Senate. And that alone is all you need to know.
Excellent. Thanks, George. And here is our final mailbag question for the week. So Marcy has a fun question for us. If we have to barricade the streets and hold the cities to save democracy, as in the Deep Space Nine episodes, Past Tense, Episode 1 and Episode 2, what skills do we all bring to the table? Now, before we get to everybody's takes here, Marcy has a question specifically for Ed. What type of wood is best suited for building barricades?
Whatever's cheapest at Home Depot. like let's be honest. What are you going to do? You're not optimizing for strength. You're definitely not optimizing for looks. I mean, if you're going out and making mahogany barriers, fine, but that makes you weirder than me. Availability is critical. You don't really care if it's crooked, and Home Depot will sell you lots of that for cheap. So stock up.
So Ed, would you say that woodworking and barricade construction might be one of your best skills?
No, because that's carpentry and not woodworking, and you should know that. You've known me long enough.
Good Lord.
For those who don't know, I did used to own a property management company and have remodeled a house or unpleasantly too. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the ones I'd feel comfortable mentioning on this podcast.
You do know that pedantry is not going to help us when it comes to the barricades, right?
I don't want the other woodworkers on my ass. But no, I mean, like, are you going to go build a cabinet about it? Are you? or are you going to go build some really shitty sawhorses and, I don't know, hope?
All right, George, what is the skill you're going to bring to the barricades and holding the Revolution buildings?
I am both very good at picking very heavy stuff up and putting it back down again, and I'm a real big target. So I'm a combination workhorse and, you know, bullet sponge.
Cannon fodder George, that's what we call you.
Economist.
All right, Propter, what about you? What is it you're going to be doing?
He's going to be muted.
Logistics. All about logistics, trying to make sure people have what they need when they need it.
Well, what are people going to need when they're barricading the streets?
Mostly people are going to need medical care.
All right.
We're going to need medical attention.
All right. So dispatch Propter. That's what we're going to tell you. Low tax speed run enjoyer. what is it you're going to contribute to the revolutionary streets?
I would rather not have the podcast put on a watch list of some kind. Being as our resident Florida man, and so we're just going to keep that one in the old hip pocket, and leave people guessing on that.
All right, so arsonists, we've got you. Excellent.
You do not question people who take air conditioners and duct tape them to the back of their car.
That's right.
Because think of what all of those skills could be used when considered for ill, or you know. Noble ill.
All right, that's it for this week's mailbag. Go to normalmenpodcast.com and check out the mailbag link to leave us a message. We'll go through the responses, and this is Go Like Hell Machine. I'll be back to do this again here in about a month.
Talk to you soon, brother. Thanks for coming out.
Good seeing you, man.
Well, this is getting out of hand. I just got a text that a cop's double meat, double cheese didn't have enough mustard. And I'm in
Charlotte, North Carolina.
That is just barely an exaggeration of reality. There was a famous one, and they have mostly knocked off the blue alert stuff. Like it has gone down from what it was a couple of years ago. But there was a famous one where they woke up the entire state of Texas at about 3:45 in the morning with a blue alert. Some guy in Lubbock or some shit place like that punched a cop. And then, I mean, and that was literally it. Like, you know, and then like the news covered it and stuff. And a little while later, we see a picture of the guy in the hospital bed and he's fucking fine. He's got a black eye, you know, he got like not even like a very impressive shiner, you know, giving a thumbs up the thumbs up from the hospital bed. And it's like, you know, you woke up the whole state for this. Like, what am I supposed to do about some shithole in Lubbock, you know, after the bars close, punching a cop? Like, what does it have to do with anything?
In a college town.
I think we call that a Lubbock makeup, right?
Somebody got punched in a college town. Imagine that.
No shit. You know, and Texas is actually one of the few civilized places left in this country where mutual combat is legal.
Oh, dang. Yeah.
Civilized?
Yeah. Well, no, like you can mutually agree to fist fight a guy in this state. I have actually seen cops supervise it.
I mean, I wasn't questioning that part.
Is there like a protocol there, or do you?
There are rules. It is supposed to be bare knuckles only, no weapons. You can't use a gun. You can't use a knife or anything like that. Only two combatants. But I have actually seen police supervise a fist fight by mutual agreement, you know, in a bar parking lot. And of course, the guys were so drunk that mostly they just kind of fell over a lot. So I can see why the cops agreed, because it was, you know, it was really funny to watch. You know, this was not a Tyson bout that we were watching.
So in addition to funding armored personnel carriers, they all have a nice stripe, you know, black and white striped shirt in the back of the car.
So for those that aren't familiar, we're, of course, referencing the hilarious Blue Alert system, which sends alerts, emergency alerts related to police in danger or perceived danger in the state of Texas. This same system is also the system that you use for emergency alerts. So, for instance, if the creek is flooding and you need to get out right now, you would presumably get an emergency alert on the same system. And they send out so many of these Blue Alert things that people turned them off. And other alerts that are important, Amber Alerts for children that have been abducted or potentially abducted, Silver Alerts for senior citizens who are maybe not aware of their surroundings and need to be retrieved, or weather emergencies don't get to people because they got spammed by the state of Texas with all these Blue Alerts. We are talking about this because this is part of the dynamic that caused so much chaos and loss of life in the Hill Country. And we wanted to have our good friend Swole on the podcast to talk about what's going on in Texas right now and what happened in Kerrville in the Hill Country and how that Blue Alert dynamic played in, as well as some of the other emergency mismanagement that took place. So Swole, welcome. We're glad to have you here, buddy.
Hi, howdy, fellas. I always forget that, you know, this is a podcast that goes by display names or whatever. I need to actually check to see what mine is right now, because it's probably something fucking dumb. I will be addressed as the oldest Waffle House FBC regional office, unless I change it before the podcast actually comes out. Well, back on Twitter, I was your himbo boyfriend with some misspellings for like 5 years, and I got sick of it. When we moved to Blue Sky, I just started changing them whenever I thought of something that I thought was funny. Swolshalism, that's me. Howdy, fellas. It's good to be here.
Wish it was under better circumstances, but so, I mean, I guess as a Texan, how has it been in the past? I guess it's been, what, 10 days since those flash floods hit? How has the last 10 days played out from sort of your perspective on the ground in the state?
I mean, it's a mess. You know, I mean, that is the one thing about being in Texas is, you know, I've been to Kerrville. I've been to the Kerrville Folk Festival. I'm familiar with the area. I think I've probably driven past that camp. Famously the camp with the kids. I think I've probably driven past there, although I don't recall it. But it's also, you know, this is horrific, and it's also way the hell away. You know, it's hundreds of miles away, and yet everything's reverberating through. One of the kids that got swept away was, I'm from Houston, a Houston kid, and there was a vigil that my wife, who's a former Houston educator, was going to go to for them. And I mean, it's just a big mess, and it is very typical of the sort of exacerbated natural disasters that we get down here with some regularity, where it is a natural disaster. Flash flooding is something that is more constrained and determined by geography than just about anything. A lot of these, you know, this place is down in these valleys, you know, you dump 8 inches of rain in an hour, there's going to be a flash flood. It's going to be bad, but there still can be warning. There still can be care, and what you allow to build in these flood prone areas could be controlled. And of course the state of Texas doesn't do any of that shit. That ain't something that they would be concerned about. As I'm sure you fellas are aware, you know, the regional government out there, you know, was given a big emergency preparedness grant, and they decided that it was repulsive to be given money to keep themselves safe by a Democratic president. And so they just kept the money because they wanted to make sure it didn't go to California, I believe is the phrasing, and didn't do anything with it, you know, Well, officially didn't do anything with it. They probably spent it on something.
Raises for the sheriff, if the news coverage is to be believed.
That would that would scan, yeah.
Now, I mean, Houston's had its own flooding problems in the not too distant past. Is this something where you see a big gradient over the state of Texas in disaster response between areas, or is this something where things at the state level are kind of dragging everybody down?
It varies. Houston is, you know, it's reclaimed swampland. Our flooding problems have gotten worse because Houston keeps getting bigger and it can't really build south and east anymore, because that's all pretty much filled in with the ocean or the ship channel or just other towns. And so things tend to happen more to the north and the west, which means that rain that happens there has to flow through us and our storm system to get down to the Gulf, because our soil is very funny. I like to joke that we don't build buildings here. We build concrete boats that float, because we have an extremely clay black soil, which is extremely absorbent and extremely changes size and shape. And, you know, and so my dad's house, we could tell when it had been a dry summer, because we'd have to run a soaker hose on the south side of the house to lift it back up, because all of a sudden we couldn't open the doors on that side of the house.
Oh, man.
No, I mean, it would move a good inch and a half on a really dry summer. But so Houston's whole storm system is mostly about channeling flows. We have the bayous, which are rivers. We call them bayous. And kind of funnily enough, a lot of the overflow is basically the streets fill and then they're supposed to drain. And there's sort of a maximum throughput issue, you know. And so our big flooding that we had just a couple of years ago was Hurricane Harvey, which came over and just sat on top of us for 2 days and dumped an ungodly amount of, you know, concentration of rain, massive, massive flooding, because it was so far beyond the throughput, the flow ability of our storm system to dump it into the ship channel and thence to the Gulf. I don't give a shit what Donald Trump says. It's just the Gulf.
There was really good reporting in the wake of Harvey too, around the paving of Prairie and
mm-hmm.
what putting asphalt and concrete over that very absorbent grassland soil does mm-hmm. in terms of creating flooding, just because now water that used to get absorbed very, very well by the grassland has nowhere to go, and water will find a level, as my friend Alex screamed yesterday when someone threw or spilled a beer on the table at the bar ahead of the Charlotte FC game.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, it's got to go somewhere. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's and you know, here in town we actually have, there's permitting requirements, I know, because we went through it a few years ago with doing some additions, and about, you know, permeability, like percentage permeability, like on the sort of top down view, what percentage is concrete versus soil. And, you know, and there's some regulations about that, but, you know, they're building out in Katy and Tomball and all these areas to the west and the north of town. And, you know, and so they're putting all this concrete down and putting all this asphalt down, and that doesn't absorb anything. And so then it becomes a flow issue.
So when there's natural disasters in kind of the more rural parts of Texas, how does that play in the city? Is that something that is sort of a statewide galvanizing issue politically? Is that something that everybody gets mad about, or is that something where things are kind of siloed, like Kerr County sort of deals with its own stuff?
A little bit of both. Like I said, I mean, Kerrville's hundreds of miles away. There's connections. People are upset. But also, frankly, I think most residents of the state of Texas are confused by the very notion that government could do much to help. You know, when we have a natural disaster roll through, we don't look for the state to come help. And everybody gets excited because HEB is going to come by with their trucks and give out free food and water to everybody.
HEB is a legendary chain of Texas grocery stores, for those who may not be familiar with the deeper Texan lore.
Incredible tortillas. I bring bags home whenever I go to Texas, which is as infrequently as possible. Sorry, Swole.
No, that's all right. You let me know, I'll ship some up to you.
Oh, brother.
I got a little bit of a sideline in that.
Tortilla muling?
They're pretty good for grocery store tortillas. There are better ones, but you know, you can't beat the 20-pack of fresh ones to take home for, you know, what are they, $4.99 for 20 or something like that. But yeah, it is that kind of thing where the state government has done so little to positively affect people's lives for so long that there's not a whole lot of looking out for it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, you guys have kind of a lot of counties, right? So you're deeply fragmented on the more local level.
Sure. And I mean, again, it's a state roughly the size of France. So, you know, it's like if you had a bit of flooding in Marseille, you ask somebody up in Normandy what they think of it. They're like, oh, that's terrible. But it's like, you know, there is a certain degree of, well, the French government is more effective than the Texas government. There is a certain degree of like, that's terrible. It's way over there.
So with that kind of cultural response and size and scale for natural disasters, I think you get some insight into what Texas politics must be like. And we have had a pretty wild week there. Propter, can you give us some background on who Ken Paxton is and what happened this week?
Sure. I can speak a little bit to Ken Paxton. He's the Attorney General of Texas and has been for some time now. He is comically, cartoonishly corrupt. He's been under federal felony investigation for essentially his entire tenure as AG. They tried and failed to impeach him. I think that was last year. And, you know, this impeachment was, I think, personally embarrassing for him for lots of reasons. But one was that he had his mistress on the payroll, and that was the topic of some of the impeachment inquiry that, you know, that his, I guess, alleged mistress, it looked like she was going to testify, and she showed up, and then she didn't actually testify anyway.
Actually, slight correction, just because time is fake. The impeachment was May 23. We have a very funny / bad system where our legislature only meets every other year. So it was last term, but that was last year, or year before last.
2 years back now.
2 years ago.
Anyway, Ken Paxton's still wife for now, is also a politician in Texas. In this last week, she announced on Twitter that they were divorcing for biblical reasons, I think was the justification that she gave, which raises more questions than it answers. This is of particular interest to the national audience because Ken Paxton is currently leading in the Republican primary polls for John Cornyn's Senate seat. Cornyn is running again, but every poll I've seen of that race has him down by about 20 to Ken Paxton in the primary. It says some things about where that primary is headed. Ken Paxton is definitely going to be a softer general election opponent than Cornyn would be. This is the kind of seat that Democrats need to take to have a chance of taking the Senate majority in 2026.
I believe in you, Texas Republicans. Don't listen to the fake news media. You can nominate Ken. He can win. I believe he absolutely will not get rinsed by that semi-sentient AI Colin Allred.
The marshmallow test is fake. You do not have to believe in the marshmallow test. Just eat that marshmallow. It'll be fine.
So I guess in Donald Trump's America, this is maybe a question that answers itself. But what's up with Texas that you guys are sticking by Ken Paxton? How does he keep getting reelected?
Well, he first of all, nobody ever went broke by underestimating the depravity or overestimating the depravity of the Texas electorate, whichever direction is the bad one. So the Paxton-Cornyn thing is fundamentally, it's partially about Paxton versus Cornyn, but what it is also a sign and a symptom of the sort of the last 10 years have had a civil war within the Texas Republican Party between for many, many years, the Texas Republican Party, of which the more traditional branch of it, of which Cornyn is a very significant member, had a consensus. They were very pro-business, anti-regulation, but sort of within more normal parameters while still being quite far to the right. But over the last decade, there has been an insurgency against that, pretty much entirely bankrolled by one man named Tim Dunn, who is, and those of you who have been to the South will shudder in fear at this, a lay evangelical Christian preacher and a West Texas oil billionaire with his own bespoke theology, of course.
Yikes.
As these guys always have.
Yikes.
Yeah. And so for the last decade, he has become a massive, massive funder, and has more or less bought out the entire entire wings of the Texas Republican Party, and and is molding it in his image. There was none of this is original reporting. I'm pulling from a lot of very good Texas journalists who have done the work on this. There's a really fascinating statistic as of a couple years ago. Tim Dunn and his various cutouts are, through the entirety of public record keeping, the third largest political donor in Texas. But he's done all of that in 10 years. And you have to drop off number two, because that was one guy from Laredo who ran a very funny self-funded governor campaign, in 1 year. And so he got himself up to number two on the all-time list just with that sort of quixotic attempt at the governor's house. So Ken Paxton is a Tim Dunn creature, as is Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, our Baltimore-born right-wing talk radio guy. The Texas Constitution is kind of where the lieutenant governor, in a lot of ways, has a lot more power than the actual governor. They are both Tim Dunn creatures.
So how has the Texas political environment changed with the introduction of Tim Dunn? Because I grew up in Oklahoma, which is not super different in terms of a political environment, but it does seem like it's real different since Dunn got involved. And just kind of what's your take on that?
Yeah, so Tim Dunn is, again, has his own bespoke evangelical theology, which has led him into a lot of very strange places. The original circa 2017 bathroom bill, which was famously defeated, the anti-trans bill, that was his and his lobbying group. It is very, very focused on anti-queer and conservative, like culture war type stuff. And he has been very focused on a lot of that. And, famously, the 2017 anti-trans bathroom bill failed because there was enough of the old line business, like sort of pro-business Republican things, to kill it, because all the business lobby were like, this is going to cost us a whole bunch of business. Nobody's going to come here. We're going to have trouble hiring people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they had enough to hold on in 2017 to kill it. And they did not have enough this year to even put up the slightest fight against fundamentally the same bill again.
Hey folks, another one from the editing bay. After we finished up, Swole let me know that there's a factual error here. The anti-trans bill referenced here is not passed yet. The Texas State Senate passed it during their session, but the Texas House ran out of time. It's slated for the special session now and is very likely to pass. Also, he now owes me a pack of tortillas. Back to the pod.
He has really transformed the Texas Republican Party into a much more culture war focused party. And Ken Paxton is a perfect man for that, because and Ken Paxton is very much a perfect man for the Trump era, in that he is loud, he is showy, he's hilariously corrupt, he's actually really ineffective at his job, but nobody cares.
We would be remiss and possibly burned at the stake on Blue Sky if we did not ask this question. What does this mean for Blexus?
Brother, I've been here my whole damn life.
That is the voice of a tired man right there, y'all. He is tired.
I will fucking believe it. Look, in a funny way, I am old line Texas Democrat. One of my sort of claims to fame is that my grandmother was personally kicked out of the women's auxiliary by Ovita Hobby for being too much of a wobbly.
That's amazing. I don't know what any of those words mean.
Yeah, but I do.
None of those words are in the Bible.
Yeah, I will believe it when I see it. It's, I've been burned too many times. As ever, a lot of the problem is, Ken Paxton is beatable if you can find somebody to beat him. And the Texas Democratic Party has not done a great job with that over the last 10 years. my personal, you know, my personal beef is I'm currently unrepresented in the United States House because they overruled because of a whole lot of stuff that we don't need to get into. But essentially, they handed the House seat to the former mayor of Houston, who promptly died, despite there being basically the runner up of the primary. She's 40 years old
and not dead.
And yeah, as far as I am aware, at the time of recording, not dead.
That is kind of important.
You'd think.
To be fair to the mayor, one has to assume that dying immediately after getting into office was not his plan A. But but still, like, you got to play around that at some point.
He'd had cancer as mayor. And that was, you know, and he was term limited out. But, you know, everybody had thought he was going into a graceful retirement. I mean, he looked like shit.
All right, brother. So,
wow. All right.
I mean, you know, he's not a young man, been quite sick for a while. He looked terrible.
I don't know how I'm going to edit that one.
We're leaving that in.
I mean, you can just cut all that shit out.
All right, brother. Before we move away from Texas here, we've talked about what's bad in Texas. We've talked about what's tough in Texas. What's good about Texas, man?
Best guys in the business. No, it's, you know, I mean, again, I live in Houston, which is by some measures the most diverse city in the country. And boy, it really is. We got, you know, and for all that it is a big sprawling plains city with bad traffic and not enough transit, it is also a big, beautiful mess of a city where you can find just about anything in the world and people from everywhere you go and hear 1,000 languages spoken everywhere. And it's beautiful.
Brother, who's got the best banh mi in Houston?
Yeah, I got to hear this too.
Oh, shit. Okay. For a long time, the answer was Le Gevrol in Midtown. But there was Le Gevrol was lost in a poker game.
Excuse me?
That is the most Texas thing I've ever heard in my life.
Le Gevrol was lost in a poker game. Then there was a divorce, and so it's the naming rights split. And so my current opinion on the best banh mi in the city of Houston, I don't have a firm one yet.
Oh, come on!
You know, I got to do a little more sampling. I'm gonna cop out on that one, man. There's too much. I mean, shit. We had the thing just a little while ago where everybody was yelling because we had, you know, faux beef kolaches and you know, some parachute guy from the New York Times came in to talk shit about it and not how beautiful a thing that was that we had, you know, kolaches are a Texas specialty. They are related to the Polish kolach, but they are it's sort of a semi-sweet bread roll with a sausage inside, usually cheese, sometimes jalapeno slices. They are distinctively a Texas dish, you know, coming out of West Texas and stuff like that. And you know, and then combining it because we have, again, you know, a huge Vietnamese community after the war and having something like a faux beef kolache come out, which has a waiting list to get that kolache, by the way, it's beautiful.
At MSR Figueroa and regroup at the Kobe statue. Swole, take your company and secure the Carl's Jr.
So we had a domestic military operation in a public park in the past week, and we need to talk about it because I think it says so much, not only about the extremely dangerous position we're in as a country, but also what complete morons are running the show and how uninterested the people with guns are in supporting that moronic attitude. Basically, there were protesters in MacArthur Park in Los Angeles. Was it the Marines Proctor? You're my go-to guy for factual recall. So was it the Marines or Army that got asked to do a show of force in the park.
Well, I think it was primarily National Guard that came through there, but
sorry, National Guard. Thank you.
But there might have been some Marines in the operation also. MacArthur Park is not the nicest part of Los Angeles, so let's get that out of the way first. That like there is a kernel of truth at the bottom of this crap pile, in that there is gang activity around MacArthur Park. It became clear looking at the planning documents for this that maybe somebody in the military command was having a little bit of fun drawing this up, even though the actual sweeping the park was not a funny thing at all. The planning documents included things like, we are likely to take sniper fire from MS-13, from building A, building B, and building C as we come into MacArthur Park. That's not going to happen, right? Like, that's not going to be a thing where you have a street gang choosing to take a pitched battle against the United States military over a public park where kids are playing soccer. I think that there's a couple of different ways to read this in terms of its status as an indicator of military-civilian relations in Southern California right now. Number one, you can read it as being very bad because you have a military show of force with military vehicles, military horses, I guess. I don't know where they got the horses. Cruising through a civilian public park, kicking kids out of the way in broad daylight. And it's bad that we're doing that. It's bad that we're having things like a military show of force in a major American city. On the other hand, if you were to, for instance, draw up an operation to try to get Stephen Miller and company off your back as a military commander, and you were trying to figure out rules of engagement and a place to do it where it would be flashy and it would produce B-roll, but it had a relatively low chance of getting anybody actually shot, then the written plan for this was probably a pretty good plan to get that done. Their abortion criteria was that if there was a protest within 3 miles of the operation, everybody was going to get in the trucks and go home. They were not, in my opinion, from having looked at the documents, they were not going in there trying to shoot anybody. And they were taking somewhat exceptional measures to ensure that no matter how hot-headed the people involved got, it was unlikely that it would come to violence. And in fact, it did not come to violence.
Some of the actual details too here are so comical that I just cannot believe somebody whose profession is being in the military came up with this stuff in an earnest attempt to show force to a civilian population. So for context, MacArthur Park is like, it's 3 blocks square, right? It's relatively small little park east of downtown LA, south of Silver Lake. If you ever heard of Silver Lake, sort of the Brooklyn of LA, it's close to that. It's a little south of that. And they have a planning document. It's an overhead map that they've got the various different phase lines drawn up on. So for context, if you're trying to plan out movements, phase lines are like objectives, basically, that you're trying to take as you maneuver through in a geography. Phase line Wildcats, phase line Bulldogs, phase line Gators. They've got a demarcated forward line of own troops, which is basically, this is as far forward as we're expecting to go in this given operation. They've got pickup zone marks. They've got exit corridors marked. It's absolutely laughable.
Yeah, it's wild. They have the Carl's Jr. marked as something to secure on the edge of the park.
Yeah, he wasn't joking.
That's not a bit. They marked the Carl's Jr. as something they needed to get their hands on.
It blows my mind because, like, I have no sense of scale for anything, you know, west of the Mississippi. And so, like, the only thing that I could think of is, how big is this compared to Central Park? Gentlemen, any idea how big this is?
It's a lot smaller than Central Park.
Oh, it's a lot smaller.
Like 10% of the size, probably?
Try more like 5.
Griffith Park is the LA equivalent to Central Park.
Yeah, this park is 1/24th the size of Central Park. That's not a lot. That's a technical term.
Yeah.
I don't understand. And
they had it that size, and they had it denoted as needing a battalion to secure it, I believe. And I...
Okay.
Somebody
Look, everyone wants to get out for the day.
Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe a battalion is like between 300 and 1,000 troops.
Correct.
In normal military terminology.
You know what they say, hard times make hardies men.
The population density of the park went up so much that everyone in the Bay Area thought to sue for the that environmental study.
You don't even have to go to the Bay Area. It was Santa Monica. It was already run into the courthouse.
We had another major operation in California, another major immigration enforcement operation, a set of them, going after agricultural workers that was, to my mind, less funny. It's resulted in at least one reported death of somebody who was running from ICE and got beaten down and later died of his injuries. And there's reports that there were military vehicles involved there as well that had unit markings blacked out. That, to me, is a more dangerous and pernicious use of military troops. You know, like the MacArthur Park operation, to tie this back to an ongoing conversation we're having here on Normal Men, had different code names for the law enforcement agencies, right? They each had a soft drink related code name. So like the FBI was Coke. I want to say that the CBP tactical unit was Fanta or something. You know, there, it seemed like somebody in the officer corps was maybe having a little fun with it.
I mean, that's fair enough to use Fanta for the CBP people.
Are we going to talk about Fanta's Nazi history on the show today, or are we going to save that for a future episode?
We have an educated audience.
This is news to me. Orange soda is from the Nazis? I had no idea.
More fool me.
I can't say that I was prepared to talk about this today, but my understanding is that the origin of Fanta is that Coke could no longer do business in Nazi Germany. So they real quick set up another business unit, Fanta, to continue to capture the Nazi German soft drink market. And then after the war, you know, they still had this Fanta unit set up that they reabsorbed. Fanta is, the history there is that it's more or less explicitly a dodge to get around World War II era sanctions.
Okay, folks, you heard it here. We're canceling Fanta.
I feel like it's emerged from cancellation. It's sort of been recycled out.
Sorry. We're re-canceling Fanta. The normal men are re-canceling Fanta. Are you happy?
Yes. I'm delighted. Thank you.
No, I think Proctor is exactly right to bring up the man who was killed while trying to escape ICE and how the real danger of the large expenditures, the money cannon that's about to be pointed at any psycho that's wanted to beat up brown people at any opportunity over the course of their life, is not what happens in the light of day and in a public park with media there and demonstration to be had of what public exercise of power looks like. It's what happens in the dark. It's what happens in the Florida Everglades. We had a report this week from a congressional delegation that visited the Everglades detention facility, as we're referring to it on this podcast, and talked about 35 people being crammed together into a tiny wire cage and being forced to eat, drink, sleep, defecate, and generally exist jowl to jowl like that. That is the danger. And the danger is where there are not cameras and there is not a public watching, because that is where the abuses will be worst. And there will be many, as there already have been, and they're going to get worse. And they're going to get much larger in scale, given the funds that have been underwritten by the Congress to make all that happen. I think you're right, Proctor. You're exactly right to be so concerned about that, as opposed to the more public effort at enforcing a regime at MacArthur Park.
I guess to move the goalposts on you a little bit, one of the reasons that I'm still basically optimistic about the future course of immigration action in California is that even with all the ink we've spilled, even with the riots, the protests, the militarization in its funny and less funny forms in Southern California, as of last week, they had only registered fewer than 2,800 detentions in all of SoCal. That's not a lot of detentions. You know, what that means is that we've seen tape of pretty close to every detention that ICE has done in Southern California. It's not like there's an iceberg, so to speak, that we're only seeing the tip of, that these actions are more or less telegraphed, but we are getting evidence of them in mass media almost every time they happen.
I think that's true, but keep in mind those 2,800 detentions in Southern California are one subset of one state. I mean, we're on pace for 500,000 detentions this year for ICE. And the scale of people that involves means mathematically that when you have as many amoral or just straight up evil goons exercising physical force against people, there are going to be deaths. There are going to be a lot of deaths. Right. And the ones that are most likely to suffer that fate are people that are already in detention or that are in a place where there isn't public light to shine on them. There isn't a camera there. There isn't a bystander with a cell phone. There isn't media. And, you know, I think you're right to point out that there is no iceberg under the water in Southern California. And that's sort of a reason for some kind of optimism. Fair enough. But it's a big country and there are hundreds of thousands of people that are going to be fed into a machine that is in some instances going to try and kill them.
Yes. Yes. Everywhere it's happening, it's very bad. I think we just need to be skeptical of the claims that particularly the people at ICE are making about the scope of what they're able to do, because they have every incentive in the world right now to exaggerate the scale of this depravity that they're going to be able to bring to bear.
That's fair. Yeah.
Tom Homan in particular has made a bunch of promises that I don't think he can keep.
Well, they are so far off from the campaign promises that it, you know, you see favorability dropping among Republicans. Oh, yeah, you promised you were going to deport 20 million people, which, you know, is twice the number of undocumented folks in this country. And but it's also, what is that, George or the math guy, 13, 14,000 people per day, every day, for every year, every day of the term of 4 years. That's like one guy per ICE employee per day, every day. It's like, you know.
And they're already going after all the low-hanging fruit they have. They're already going after everybody where they know where they're going to be because they're showing up for court dates or they're showing up for doctor's appointments.
And honestly, they're not even managing to get all of those people, right? Like, the level of dysfunction is so high that, you know, we're seeing a shocking number of the people being arrested pretty much every time. Like, to your point earlier, it's not just the people in Southern California. This is we're seeing a high proportion of all of the cases, and a lot of the messaging is just hoping you extrapolate it out and get scared.
There was really good reporting this week on that in The Atlantic, where they talked about the morale at ICE, and it is not in a good place. And it's not in a good place because, oh, we're all just, you know, we don't want to deport anybody, and, you know, these Trump guys are bad and we're just trying to do our jobs as civil servants. No, it's not that. It's we are literally being asked to do things we are not capable of doing and being punished when we can't get them done. And to be clear, I do not feel sorry for these people at all. I hope every single person that's involved in ICE in any capacity as of roughly January 6th of this year, and probably before that, maybe a little bit more nuanced, but probably before that as well, I hope all of them are miserable at all times going forward. I hope they never recover from the psychic damage they take from participating in that particular engine of misery. But I will say, if your people aren't happy, they're not going to do a good job. And for the record, Swole, you were pretty on it there. 13,698.63 people per day if you're going to hit 20 million over the four-year term.
Swole also brought up the point that the polling on immigration generally for Trump has been dropping like a rock. That's been a little bit of a surprise to me. I thought that there would be a little bit more bounce in his immigration numbers, but it seems like there's a lot of people who were kind of in the middle of the road who are in the process of being radicalized out of this one.
But he's losing them at both ends, right? Like, they promised a bajillion deportations that don't exist, and also not quote unquote the good ones. There was no way this was going
to
work.
I like to joke around that the average American voter knows two things about our immigration laws and policy, and they're both wrong. And that is that's quite a hill to climb for any politician, let alone one as dumb as Donald Trump. The, you know, one of the the one of the basic problems is that people think that there is fundamentally, you know, in a real way, there is a way to legally immigrate to this country in a practical sense, you know, and people, so people don't want people to cheat, but they don't want you to be, you know, cruel to people neither. And so you get this sort of contradiction where nobody's happy because fundamentally the American voter doesn't know shit and won't learn.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's part of the reason why this move to asylum as a major avenue of immigration met with such backlash from the middle is that this was something that was essentially dictated by our failure to reform immigration law at any point since most optimistically the 90s. Realistically, the 80s was when the major reform happened. But we had all this kind of technical debt built into the system, and there's obviously strong demand for people to immigrate to the United States. So when it became clear that there was an avenue where you could come to the United States and claim asylum, lots and lots of people did. Whether those are all what we would think of as being refugee asylum claims, or whether some of that was economic migration from under another name, that's one for the immigration system to figure out. But it was clear that things like the CHNV programs that were meant to essentially provide asylum for people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela that could make a credible case without having to come to the border so that they would do that instead of coming to the border. And we had pretty good results there as long as we gave people another way to get into the country. People weren't braving the desert and the river. They were going through other channels instead.
I would point out, too, that the reason that that asylum channel into the United States, that way of hopping the border, turning yourself into Border Patrol, the reason that exists is because it's in U.S. code. And people are now trying to change that without actually doing things like, for instance, passing a bill through Congress.
Right.
And if there was a serious relationship in this country between how our institutions worked and how our public opinion moved over time, then maybe that would have changed. Maybe that would be the right thing. Maybe that would be the wrong thing. But if people wanted to change it, there is an avenue to do so. And it can't happen because there will never be 60 votes in the Senate to change those laws, because there's a lot of history tied up in that. Well, never is a long time now, to quote my tight ends coach from college. But there is no foreseeable future where you'll get 60 senators to vote to end asylum laws in this country. So you're left with a situation where you have to make the best with what you have. And that's almost entirely due to the structure of our political institutions as they're written down in the Constitution from 250 years ago.
Right. I mean, the way everybody thinks, I shouldn't say everybody, the way that many people think immigration should work is, you know, there's a line and it's of reasonable length and you go and you stand in the line and then maybe it takes a couple years, but it doesn't take a couple decades. And then, you know, you get in and you have done it the right way. And then you are on a path to being an American citizen. And that line doesn't exist. There's no line you can go stand in to do that. So anyway, speaking of things that people believe in that we have to therefore take seriously politically that aren't necessarily the truth, we wanted to return to a topic that is near and dear to our heart here at Normal Men, Guanzo. As you may recall from, I think it was episode 12, the Guanzo principle, Guanzo theory, is the theory that if a significant fraction of the electorate believes in something, even if that something is entirely crazy, even if that something is Guanzo, the monster that eats power lines, then as a politician, you have to pay some attention to this imaginary construct that the voting public has decided is real. What we are now seeing in the Guanzo space is that Trump, having demagogued on the Epstein files for some time, has now created a situation where his own MAGA base, especially the MAGA influencer base, who make their money off of doing things like insinuating that high-profile celebrities are sex trafficking children, are unsatisfied with his Justice Department's decision to not release the Epstein files.
I'm sure you're wondering, if you're not terminally online or really plugged into this kind of stuff, like what are the Epstein files? Who are y'all talking about? So just to back it up a bit, Jeffrey Epstein was a guy who should not have had the connections he had and parlayed those connections into some sort of sex trafficking operation. These specific details remain unclear. Some of them have come out in other court cases. There are entire podcasts dedicated to this guy's track record. And a lot of it was very bad. I don't want to get too far into details for both my own sanity and for y'all's, but suffice to say, there was some sort of fire here in addition to all the smoke. He ended up allegedly killing himself in federal custody. What would it have been? 8 years ago now?
Something like that.
Six years ago?
Yeah. And has become the subject of conspiracy theories in addition to the fact that there was definitely some bad stuff going on. One of the reasons for this is because he very, very likely, I don't want to say certainly, I don't want to say did because I'm not an expert in this area and I don't want to get over my skis here, but almost certainly had a list of clients that included a lot of politically powerful people and almost certainly from both parties. Again, I don't want to say certainly, almost certainly from both parties, including potentially ex-presidents, etc. The assumption from a lot of people is that the current president is one of those clients. There is no hard evidence to this effect, but it's certainly possible. And that has been seized upon by people that are worried the files are not being released because he wants to protect himself, or maybe he wants to protect other people. But either way, it's a conspiracy and the right's going nuts about it. And there has basically been an online civil war over it over the past week.
Yeah, I mean, they've been throwing red meat at their base. At their base from day one, right? Like they've pretty much everything you just said, George, except for the notion that Trump himself is on it, is something that at least one person within that orbit has said, right? Like none of this stuff is new. Every single one of them has been playing with it. And now they have the shocked Pikachu face on that their own people, what's the word, believed them in what they said. And of course they're going to be mad. And the real question is just like, how mad are they? Do they stay mad? Do they continue to buy into this? Does it deactivate them? Probably not. Let's be real. But in the interim, it is getting a little weird what the Democrats are doing, right? Like, Gavin Newsom is out there playing this up, and he's Gavin Newsom, so he is beneath notice. But like Senator John Ossoff is going out there and making some pretty loud nods towards this sort of thing. And that makes me a little uncomfortable, to be honest, because yeah, they probably existed, but do you know? Right? Like, are you reacting to the idea that they existed? Or are you reacting to the idea that Republicans have said this for so long, right? Like, are you buying into a certain kind of consensus psychosis? Or are you actually responding to real things? And I think there is a real danger to that, especially as you look at sort of the online space here, because these narratives may or may not have any basis in reality. And you shouldn't trust that Pam Bondi will tell you what time of day it is. But it's also really, really weird that the Democrats are now just going publicly assuming that it's real in sort of the way that they're winking and nodding at this. I feel pretty torn about that.
I think it's fair enough to say, look, Pam Bondi said she had the list on her desk. Where's the list, Pam?
Yeah, totally.
You guys have been yammering about this Epstein client list for, you know, the better part of a decade now. You said to all of these people that it existed, it's on your desk, awaiting review, and then you just pulled the rug out from under all of these folks. You know, you made your bed there, lie in it.
True. But at the same time, like, and I fully agree with you, like, a lot of this is coming out of that space. Although it should also be acknowledged, some of this seems like it's just like looking like the usual grifters are looking for the exits. But also, let's follow this through, right? Like, say it does exist. Say it comes out.
Right.
There is no way you are ever going to see Donald Trump's name on this. even if it was there, right? No copy is ever going to come out in his lifetime with Donald Trump's name on it, because they have control of those information channels.
Right.
But say it does come out, now you just look like participating in the stupid because I don't think asking, hey, Pam Bondi, where is this? I don't think that's a problem. What I am very concerned about is the way that they're kind of nudging that, oh, of course Trump is on it. Because even if he is, you're not going to ever get that proof, and there's no upside in that.
I think what Ed is sort of grappling with here is, are we in a permanent post-truth politics, or can a politics grounded in material reality return to the fore?
It better.
And if we're in a permanent post-truth politics, then Ed, I'm sorry, I think you're wrong. If we're not, then I think you're bang on.
I mean, if we're not, we're all dead. So hooray.
I don't know what kind of relationship Trump and Epstein had through the period that they were described as being constant companions in the New York nightlife, which was about a decade. But it seems clear to me that there are ties there, you know, that these guys hung out for a long time together. Maybe they did that shooting pool. Maybe they did that on the occasions where Epstein was not abusing underage girls. I don't want to get over invested in the specifics of that, but in the right-wing media sphere, the Epstein list has been built up as sort of the ultimate reward for QAnon faithfulness. That this is the set of strings that when you start to pull them, it will unravel this whole conspiracy that has ensnared the world, and all of the wicked people will be punished and the virtuous will be rewarded. It's kind of an apocalyptic thing. I think that is a problem that Trump needs to manage. I don't think the Democratic Party as an institution needs to take a stance on this, but if John Ossoff wants to jab at it, yeah, you know, he's a big boy. He can run his own campaign.